Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby from Bennington, Vermont. 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is former Conservation Commissioner for the State of New York and former President of the National Audubon Society, Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, we'll take a look at the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge. Congress is trying to open this area up for oil drilling, and so far the Clinton administration has blocked the move. But the effects on native people and wildlife could be catastrophic. And then we'll look at the future of electricity. All states are expected to deregulate their electric utilities, but no one knows what the consequences will be. Some fear electric rates will go up and polluting energy plants will be favored over clean ones. We asked you for ideas about how to have a sustainable Hanukkah and Christmas, and some of you got back to us. We'll run through your suggestions. And our Ear to the Ground will feature folks dedicated to preserving rare and endangered plant species. These stories and more coming up this week on The Environment Show. On the top of the world, where Alaska meets the Arctic Ocean on the north and Canada on the east, lies the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. A flat plain extends south from the coast for about 80 miles where it runs smack up against the Brooks Mountain Range. It's a wild and remote place without roads or trees. When I hiked across it in August, the end of summer was punctuated by blowing snow and tundra that had turned yellow and red like fall foliage. This federal land is protected as a national wildlife refuge by a law which Alaskan representatives and the oil companies have been desperately trying to change so the plain can be opened up for oil drilling. A few years ago, during the Bush administration, the Senate debated whether to open the refuge to drilling, but after a bruising filibuster, the legislation was set aside. This year, without hearings or further debate, authorization to drill the refuge was put in the budget reconciliation bills and passed by both houses. The president vetoed that bill, in part because of his commitment to protect the refuge. In the ongoing budget negotiations, the future of the refuge will come up again. The budget impact of drilling is unclear. Congressional budgeteers estimate revenue of $1.3 billion to the Treasury in 5 to 7 years, but the administration numbers are much lower. They estimate revenue at $850 million. Both numbers assume the formula in the Alaska Statehood Act, which gives Alaska 90% of oil revenues, can be changed to a 50-50 split. Alaska has said it will sue for the full 90%. And if Alaska prevails, the feds could wind up with a mere $170 million, which will do little to balance the budget. Meanwhile, we'll have changed America's last remaining wilderness Arctic ecosystem forever. The refuge is also the calving ground for 160,000 caribou who migrate across the Canadian border each spring and return to Canada in the fall. Since before recorded history in the area began, an Aboriginal people, the Gwich'in, have lived on the edge of the coastal plain. Bruce Babbitt is the U.S. Secretary of the Interior. He is steward of the refuge and opposes drilling. Babbitt describes the area and the impact of proposed development.
The impact on the refuge is a complex question. I can tell you that I've spent a considerable amount of time up there, and it's really an incredible sight to see, you know, tens of thousands of caribou in a migratory pattern that stretches from the shores of the Arctic across the Brooks Range to the south side, then across into the Mackenzie River, a drainage of Canada in this seasonal cycle, and then back to the Arctic Plain where in this pageant of wildlife with the wolves stalking along, the grizzly bears down in the tundra, the musk oxen, all these animals mingling in this sort of, you know, age-old pageantry. It's really incredible. And these landscape-type migrations don't exist anywhere in the world outside of the Serengeti in Africa and the Alaska Wildlife Refuge. They're inevitably disrupted. The pieces begin to fall out all of a sudden. Sure, you still have some animals, but they're zoo specimens. They're semi-tame, standing around oil pipelines. That's not what this wildlife refuge is about. It's about something much larger, much more mystical than animals standing in cages with the oil companies say, see, it's not extinct. You can go see it at the county zoo.
7,000 Gwich'in live on the caribou migration route on the Canadian side of the border. They believe that disrupting the coastal plain will threaten their culture and their future. Canada's ambassador to the United States, Raymond Chrétien, has voiced Canadian support for the Gwich'in and opposition to the opening of the plain.
I've been made aware of the utter, the great dependence of the Gwich'in on the porcupine caribou herd, not only for their nutrition, but also for their social cohesion, for their cultural identity. And in case you do not know, the word Gwich'in means the people of the caribou. So for them, it's a matter of life and death. The second message that I received from the Gwich'in was one of tremendous anxiety, that development in the 1002 lands would disrupt the cycle followed by the caribou and by extension by the Gwich'in people for not only hundreds but thousands of years.
Norma Cassie, spokesperson for the Gwich'in, spoke to us from Canada's Yukon Territory about the relationship between the caribou and her people.
Well, my people have lived in this area for untold generations since we believe since time began. And we have lived with the animals in the Arctic and have taken care of each other for thousands and thousands of years. We consider ourselves as kin to the animals that we share the lands with, and we have lived with this caribou and taken care of them for thousands of years.
The Gwich'in are certain that opening the coastal plain would disrupt caribou calving and spell the end for their native culture.
Any kind of development in this very sensitive Arctic ecosystem and in the calving grounds of these animals, in the birthing grounds of these birds and animals and the fish in that area would be detrimental. There will be a lot of development of drilling pads, pipelines, roads, and infrastructures to house 5,000 to 6,000 people is being predicted for this area, and it would be detrimental to the whole of the Arctic ecosystem and the caribou, and this would mean the ultimate cultural genocide of my people.
Some Alaskan Eskimos who are not Gwich'in but also hunt caribou do not share the view of Alaskan and Canadian Gwich'in that oil drilling on the refuge would be detrimental. Oliver Levitt, first vice president of the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation in Alaska, and Nancy Cassie, spokesperson for the Gwich'in people, lock horns over the question, will oil drilling on the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge threaten the porcupine caribou herd and the Gwich'in culture? Mr. Levitt.
I think in no way does the caribou herd or the Gwich'ins get threatened by the drilling in the Anwar. History has taught us over the years that Canada has drilled about 180 wells in the wintering grounds of the caribou. They have built Dempster highways through the heart of the wintering grounds. Nothing has happened to the caribou. The Prudhoe Bay experience that we have in the last 20 years have taught us that the caribou herds there in Prudhoe Bay have grown six times full. And so, in our experience, have the caribou herds declined, and I don't think that this would also hurt the people, the Gwich'in people that depend on the caribou. We also depend on the caribou ourselves. We're also subsistence hunters over the years and have hunted for many, many years.
Thank you. Ms. Casey.
Yes, the area that we're talking about, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, a very sacred and beautiful area with very special plants that feed many birds and animals. And it's a calving ground, the birthing place of this caribou herd, the Porcupine River caribou herd. And that area is the only place for the porcupine caribou to have their young ones. There is no other place. They do calve a little bit in Canada, but the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is the core calving grounds, and there is no other place for them. If there is to be development there, it will be massive. There will be extraction of tons and tons of gravel, hundreds of miles of roads and pipelines. There will be drilling pads. There will be seaports that will be there. There will be facilities that will supposed to be built for 5,000 to 6,000 people in that area. If they even go in there to explore,
Thank you.
Very detrimental to that area.
Mr. Levitt, in reply.
I don't agree with that, that there would be devastation of the caribou. The development with the new technology that the industry has developed over the years, the developed area would be a very small area. We are talking about 1.5 million acres, and it is not the only place that the caribou is born. I mean, I don't like this thing about that this is the birthing place. I mean, caribou is born everywhere.
Thank you. Ms. Casey, in reply, the last word.
The caribou don't have any other place to calve. This is a special area for insect relief off the coastal winds of the Arctic. I have seen caribou being born that are aborted on their way to the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and within hours they're gone. They die. There is no other place for them to give birth. And this is a very sacred area, and the people, the Gwich'in people, have lived on the caribou for all these years. The whales offshore that the Inupiaq people depend on, they do not want any development in the migratory route of the whales. And I would like to ask Mr. Leavitt, how come they stop development on their offshore if they want the money and the oil so bad? Why aren't they developing the oil that's been found on their offshore?
Thank you.
Because they are very sensitized to the whales, the migratory route of the whales.
Thank you. Our time is up. Thank you both.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
If the Alaska delegation continues to include the future of the Arctic Wildlife Refuge in the budget bills, its fate and the fate of the Gwich'in people may well be decided without the public discussion and debate which has kept the area pristine and undeveloped in the past. The holiday season has arrived, and Americans once again are crowding malls and department stores. Most of us consume more during this time than some people in third world countries consume in a lifetime. There probably aren't enough resources to keep this up forever, so we asked our listeners how we can achieve a sustainable Christmas or Hanukkah. Mary Carmen from Brookline, Massachusetts, suggests wrapping presents using the brown paper from bags. She and her daughter spend some time finger painting the paper in holiday themes. Another suggestion is to use popcorn instead of styrofoam peanuts or packing material. Some styrofoam is made with ozone-damaging chemicals, and none of it is biodegradable. The Environmental Working Group suggests serving vegetables with less pesticide residue. Strawberries, green and red bell peppers, spinach, cherries, and peaches that are not organically grown carry the heaviest pesticide load. Fruits and vegetables are an essential part of a good diet. But in this holiday season, give the gift of organic vegetables to yourself or your family. And Greg Ward, a horticulturalist from Ward's Nursery in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, has some thoughts about Christmas trees, which he points out are sustainable products grown on family farms.
With a cut tree, of course, it's done. There's no root ball on it, and so you're using it as a Christmas tree. After the fact, there are a couple of ways you can use that tree. One is to just set it out by your bird feeder as a perching area for birds to land in prior to the before they land on your feeder. And the other way to use it is to cut the branches off of it and use them to mulch your perennial herbaceous perennial gardens to cover plants in our area that might be subject to freezing and thawing that damages the plant. And so by covering them with various greens or mulches, the ground stays frozen and keeps them in better shape. But for another use is to get a live tree. A live tree, of course, would have a root ball attached to the tree. You would then use the tree in your house and then plant it outside when you're done. And then that tree, of course, would grow into something mature in your yard.
If you have any suggestions about how to achieve a sustainable Hanukkah or Christmas, or want to tell us about anything else, write us at 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. Or you can email us at envshow@aol.com. That's envshow@aol.com. I'm Peter Burley. Today, buying electricity is relatively simple. Just about all of us power our homes and businesses through the local utility. But in the next decade, all of that will change. And as Thomas Lally reports, the environment and your pocketbook might come out the loser.
Power plants have changed a lot in the past 20 years. This plant in North Dartmouth, Massachusetts, is typical of the new generation of plants. It's small, efficient, runs on natural gas, and isn't owned by a utility. A private company called Energy Management Incorporated owns it. They're one of thousands of so-called independent power producers across the nation. Jim Gordon is EMI's president. Today, Gordon is required to sell all his electricity to a utility, something Gordon once changed. He wants to see utilities deregulated. This would allow him to sell electricity on the open market.
What we're pushing for is the ability for the consumer to have a choice in selecting who their power supplier should be. And why shouldn't that be the case? Because any manufacturer around here can pick their long distance telephone carrier. They can buy pumps and valves from various vendors. And electricity is a commodity that should be placed in a competitive situation.
So in the future, buying electricity will be a lot like buying long-distance telephone service. You'll have to choose from a variety of companies. But will this be better for the environment and your wallet? Many experts say not necessarily. Under the current system, government regulators retain strict control over just about all aspects of a utility, from what prices they can charge to where they can put their transmission lines. With deregulation, the companies which generate electricity will have more freedom. And this means there will be cutthroat competition, with companies vying for a piece of a pie previously off-limits to them. Some companies will thrive, while others will go under. Carl Gustin is a senior vice president with the Boston Edison Utility Company. He says his company may stop generating electricity entirely.
In the generation market, that is going to be commodity-driven, probably with very tight margins. And we have to take a hard look at our own operations as we go forward to see if, in fact, our fossil and nuclear generating units will be able to compete.
And Boston Edison isn't alone. Utilities across the country will soon be facing competition from companies much better suited to a deregulated market. In this light, getting out of the generation business seems like a good idea. But will those who replace the utilities do a better job? That question worries many environmentalists.
It's theoretically possible that you could have a dirty coal plant that would thrive in a new regulatory regime.
Tom Thompson is the executive director of the Northeast Sustainable Energy Association. He stresses that all costs associated with energy production should be taken into account. Today, for instance, oil is considered a cost-effective fuel. And on the surface, it is. It's cheap, abundant, and the technology to use it is everywhere. So how can more environmentally friendly energy be encouraged? Thompson says they can't until the playing field is leveled.
The only way renewables and energy efficiency are going to survive in a more competitive structure is, in fact, if they are given some type of preference. If we continue to keep the external costs of air pollution, of waste disposal, of vulnerability to foreign supplies of oil, if those rules are not going to be changed, it is true that renewables and energy efficiency will not survive.
But supporters of deregulation say the market will do what the public demands. James Gordon from EMI says the public's desire for cleaner burning fuels has led to power plants like his, which run on natural gas and are much cleaner than their predecessors.
In terms of renewable energy, which the cost may be inherently larger, if society wants those renewable technologies, they have to be prepared to fund the incremental cost.
But Tom Thompson is worried, not just about sustainables, but also about who will benefit from competition. The industries that have been deregulated recently, like the airline and long-distance phone companies, were all markets that were growing. But the electric industry is downsizing. Thompson says that means there is less money to go around, and only the wealthy might see their electric bills go down.
The question is whether or not the benefits of that are going to be spread amongst all customers or are going to be captured and consolidated amongst some of the richer, more powerful customers, especially the large industrial customers.
Deregulation is still in its infancy. Although some innovative programs have started in California and parts of the Northeast, a true free market system is still a long way off, but few doubt that it's coming. The question is, what will it look like? Officials say the goal of deregulation is to encourage innovation and savings. Whether that translates into a better environment and inexpensive energy for everyone may only be answered in hindsight. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
Ear to the Ground, with stories about people affecting change in the environment. This week, Seed Savers Exchange, saving the seeds that feed us all. In the early 1970s, Diane and Kent Wheely moved to the northeastern Iowa farm of Diane's terminally ill grandfather. In the year that they lived there, Kent Wheely says Grandpa Ott taught them a lot about gardening and gave them three kinds of garden seeds that his father had brought over from Bavaria.
One was a large pink German tomato, another was a pole bean that he just called a snipple bean, and then there was also a little morning glory that was purple and had a red star in its throat, really a beautiful little thing.
They didn't know it then, but those three seeds would generate Seed Savers Exchange, an organization founded by the Wheelies' commitment to preserve endangered vegetables, fruits, and grains from extinction.
These heirloom varieties are, many of them are right on the edge of being lost, and a lot of it has to do with the farm crisis and so many young people moving off the farm into the cities, and a lot of the older gardeners no longer have anyone to pass their seeds down to, and that's the gap that we are bridging with our work.
Preserving genetic diversity, Seed Savers Exchange now maintains about 15,000 varieties of seeds, about 4,000 tomato varieties alone. Over the past 20 years, Seed Savers Exchange, located in Decorah, Iowa, has grown into a network of over 8,000 people worldwide. These people, who are as diverse as the seeds they save, range from grandmothers in their backyards to university researchers. Altogether, they are helping to maintain and exchange old-time vegetables.
So these are just varieties that have never been available commercially, that have just always been handed down from generation to generation, usually within various farm families.
Like Grandpa Ott, Wheely says immigrants brought these seeds with them from their homelands. Not knowing what lay ahead and afraid that they might be taken away, these seeds were often smuggled in socks or sewn into the linings of suitcases. Wheely says the seeds were a link to the immigrants' past and assured they would continue to enjoy them in their own country.
We're maintaining varieties within our collections that supposedly came over on the Mayflower, and varieties that were carried by the Cherokee over the Trail of Tears in 1837, and just on and on and on.
In the same way, Seed Savers Exchange hopes to preserve our vanishing vegetable heritage so that not only will breeding material for future food crops be preserved, but also to ensure that a tomato be known for its tender taste and not just the ability to withstand machine harvesting and shipping. With Ear to the Ground, this is Linda Anderson.
Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. If somebody accuses you of being a couch potato, take a cue from Seed Savers and tell them you're just a part of our vanishing vegetable heritage. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 309. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Thomas Lally is the producer. Dr. Alan Chartog is the executive producer. The Environment Show is made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. Join us next week on The Environment Show.